So let's talk about the first Americans. Where am I recording? Oh, there I am. Huh, okay. So let's talk about what we can consider the first Americans. And what I mean by that is the first human beings on the American continent. So we have to have an American continent for that to happen. So what we're dealing with is after that mega continent Pangaea breaks up, we have an American continent and it's got no human beings on it. So how did human beings get there? The most accepted theory used by most archaeologists and historians is the idea of the land bridge principle. So this is the idea that as one of the great ice ages diminishes, the glaciers over North America and Siberia begin to weaken, begin to melt, and what they reveal is a land bridge linking Asia and America across the Bering Strait. But simultaneous to that, most of the water is locked in those big glaciers, so the sea levels are lower. So you have this combo, right? Glaciers breaking up and melting, but still enough of the sea level lowered by those glaciers. People can walk across that land bridge. And they're able to do that before the sea level rises from all that melting ice. But we're talking years here, right? Not minutes. It's not like they ran across before the sea came back. Okay, but once they do, the sea level rises again, hides the bridge, and effectively traps those people on the new continent. The most common date people go with for this is about 35,000 years ago. Though this is a subject of a lot of debate, with some recent archaeological finds suggesting even earlier. Those new inhabitants in the Americas then moved down the continent all the way to South America. Many different groups and tribes emerge, about 2,000 different languages. Notable examples, obviously, in the south, we could talk about the Inca in modern Peru, who build elaborate roads and bridges, the Maya in the Yucatan Peninsula, who are known for all these incredible stepped pyramids. And later, of course, we have to think about the Aztec in Mesoamerica. Very important for the people of the Americas is the development of maize, probably in what is now Mexico, about 7 to 5,000 BCE. The original plant, known as teosinte, is a tiny plant. It has an ear about the size of your thumb, but over generations, it's been developed into the modern plant we see today. And this is really important because if we look at humans, we need to look at how they move from hunter-gatherers, moving around and gathering what food was there and hunting wildlife, to farmers, because farmers stay in one place. And maize provides a staple crop that enables that to happen. Maize then allows towns and cities to flourish because people are staying in one place and it's producing enough calories for them to all live in that place without having to move around, and sufficient extra calories that not everybody has to be working gathering food. So they can then go off and learn to do other things and create a much more complex society. Maize is being cultivated in North America by about 2000 BCE. In North America, we should definitely talk about the Pueblo people. They're probably the first North American maize growers. They live in that classic early adobe house, dried mud buildings. They're organized into what we call a Pueblo. Now, Pueblo is a Spanish word, so we're not using the term they would have used themselves prior to the arrival of Europeans. But a pueblo are these villages or towns, or those particular type of adobe houses, and a really iconic image of this region. If you go to New Mexico today, you'll see that this building style is still present, and it's really incredible how wildlife preserved their history and identity. And they made cultivation of maize possible through really elaborate irrigation systems that drew water away from rivers to make land suitable for planting. Also notable were the group we now know as the Mound Builders, who built large ceremonial mounds in the Ohio Valley. We still know very little about them compared to lots of other groups, but we do know that Cahoica in eastern St. Louis hosted about 40,000 people. We can also talk about eastern groups, and these are probably the ones most famous for the development of what we now call Three Sisters Farming, which is where you grow maize, beans, and squash together, and the maize stalks provide like a trellis, a frame for the beans to grow on, and the maize and the beans, then their leaves give shelter for the squash at the bottom and allow moisture to remain in. So the combination of the three provide a very effective farming technique. And these groups are thought to have one of the best diets of all the Native American tribes. They're typified by groups like the Cherokee, the Creek, the Choctaw, and the Iroquois. Really notably, the Iroquois are a fascinating group. The Iroquois Confederation were, and to a degree still are, a group of five tribes around the area of modern New York State. Really interesting in that they're matrilineal in terms of authority, meaning that power is passed down through the female line, as opposed to patrilineal, where the power is passed through the male line. Each tribe within the Confederacy kept their independence, but they met to discuss matters of common interest, such as war and defense. It's effectively a federal system. This was by no means the norm, though. Most of the tribes were distinct and separate, though it's important to note they were usually united by large language families and especially trade. It seems that many native tribes had very different views of some important ideas compared to Europeans. And we have to be very careful because we're often generalizing and using reports gathered by early Europeans. There really are no generalizations that can be made about the many, many different cultures of the Americas. It's dangerous to do it, and it oversimplifies a complex and diverse continent of people. However, for the purpose of simplicity and sanity, and easy understanding of how Europeans saw them, let's summarize a few ideas that seem to be common in European perceptions of them. Here are some of the ones that seem to be common, not universal. So what did Europeans arriving say about them that we have to think may or may not have been true? So we think many Native American tribes of that time period, the very early pre-Columbian Americans, had a different relationship to land ownership than the Europeans who were going to arrive. The concept of individual land ownership seems to be quite rare, especially in the eastern tribes. The tribes certainly owned land in some cases, or certainly controlled land. They communally held various areas of land, but even then, we often see ideas that the land is held in trust for some higher power or for future generations. We don't see that idea of private land ownership found in much of Europe. We can also say that many native tribes have observed what we can call animism, where they perceive nature as full of spirits, giving a lot of different deities and powers that can be appealed to. This is very opposed to the monotheistic Christian faith that the Europeans observed. However, there is a parallel in some cases between the many spirits representing parts of nature and the various Catholic saints who represent in their own way different ideals and virtues, and that's going to become especially relevant when the Spanish interact with the Mesoamericans. And you'll see a form of syncretism where the Mesoamericans are able to take some of the deities that they revere or spirits they revere and line them up with some of the Catholic saints to create a really cohesive religion. In many cases, we're also dealing with a fundamental respect for nature rather than seeing it as being there to be tamed or exploited. This contrasts very deeply with the concept presented in, say, the Bible's book of Genesis, where it's seen that God gives the land to be used by man, to be subdued and put to use. It also clashes with the very influential writer John Locke, who is probably one of the most important Enlightenment thinkers, and he very much suggests that if you are not using and improving land, then you don't really have a claim to ownership. Obviously, this will get used by Europeans as an excuse to take land from the native peoples down the road. We also see little or no examples of the concept of money. We're dealing with barter systems where goods are exchanged directly. Some groups are thought to have used wampum, a form of shells and jewelry, as a bit of universal currency. But in general, money was not really a relevant idea when Europeans arrive. The first Europeans to come to North America were almost certainly Scandinavians, probably from modern Norway. About 10,000 AD, there's evidence of Leif Erikson, son of Erik the Red, leaving Norway, sailing to Iceland, then Greenland, then on to Newfoundland, which they named Vinland. However, they were not there long, in terms of a long-term settlement. They didn't leave much in the way of records, so they didn't get a lot of credit for it. But we've now found record of it in Viking sagas and archaeological evidence. So what's driving the Europeans to come to the Americas? And to understand that, we need to put the American continent away for a moment. And instead of looking west, we need to look east from Europe. In fact, that's the only way we can understand the encounter between Europeans and Americans.
In the medieval period, Europeans engaged in what are known as the Crusades. This is military campaigns by European Christians to take control of the regions known as the Holy Land. That is, the places literally named in the Bible, Jerusalem, the surrounding lands, from the Muslim peoples who currently controlled them. Even though this was a series of wars, it ended up leading Europeans to spending considerable time in the region, sometimes as rulers. This establishes a demand for the products that can be found in that area, even after the Crusades ended. This in turn led to a long-distance trade network, especially in spices, from places like India, China, and Indonesia. So Europeans began to travel to these regions, notably Marco Polo coming back from China with his stories from the area in his book. The challenge of this trade is that it was overland. At least in the most part, it had to cut through a lot of regions that were held by Islamic kingdoms, and this caused all sorts of problems. Everyone along the route wanted to make some money off it, so this kept the prices for those spices very high. You had to go overland, at least until you reached the Mediterranean. And in the Mediterranean, the trade in those goods was a major factor in the wealth of some cities like Venice. So again, there was a strong monopoly on controlling this trade of Mediterranean shipping. Given that these Italian nations had a lock on the Mediterranean trade, Portugal, go look on a map where Portugal is, it will start to make sense, Portugal began to look for alternative supply routes for these spices. The King of Portugal actually sponsored sailors trying to find a better way to get to what were known as the Spice Islands, those especially being Indonesia. With this support and the development of new technologies, such as the type of ship known as the caravel, they succeeded in sailing around the southern tip of Africa. The caravel is a crazy important adventure for this. It has a triangular sail which allowed it to very effectively sail at an angle into the wind. This allowed it to sail back up the African coast where the wind blew against them. Also, you get the compass and the astrolabe being invented in Europe by this point, although the compass has been around in the East for a much longer period. See our discussion of East-West trade we just had, right? This allowed them to try and work out where a ship's latitude was at any point, and it's really important for working out how they're going to sail off into these complex unknown areas. This is also where the Portuguese start to interact with the African slave trade, and you know that's going to go great. Slavery was not initially broadly drawn on race lines. A slave was from any defeated opponent or group of peoples. In fact, as historians, we're pretty sure the word slave comes from the word Slav, an Eastern European ethnic group. But the first African slave trade was across the Sahara Desert, carried out probably by North Africans. As the Portuguese and others moved down the west coast of Africa, they established tribes and families they could work with to collect slaves on the coast for export. This is the beginning of the slave trade from West Africa. Some of these slaves already found themselves working on the earliest sugar plantations the Portuguese had established on their islands off the African coast. The control of the trade going around Africa obviously interested Spain, along with, you know, the slave trade. To that end, Isabella and Ferdinand, the rulers of Spain, commissioned sailors, including an Italian captain named Columbus, to find other routes to the Spice Islands, that's the East Indies, you know, the parts near India, to the east, that's Indonesia, that's Southeast Asia. But they wanted them to do it, rather than going around Africa, where the Portuguese controlled the route, go west. This would bypass that Portuguese domination of African coastal trade, and it would cut out the long journey around Africa, which was pretty long and pretty dangerous. Now, it's important to note it's a complete myth that anybody in this period really thought the Earth was flat, or at least probably no more folks than believe it now. There's no evidence of it being a belief that was widely held. No one was saying Columbus wouldn't make it because he'd sail off some edge of the world. In fact, most people thought Columbus wouldn't make it because he'd run out of food and water. In fact, Columbus had probably wildly misjudged the size of the Earth. The Greek scientist Eratosthenes calculated the circumference of the Earth in around 250 BCE, and he was out by less than 1,000 miles. But Columbus was probably convinced it was about a third of that size. So he believed he'd make it to the East Indies in, you know, a few weeks. Obviously, we know that's not true. And after 30 days at sea, when he struck land, he was convinced he'd made it to the East Indies, and he used the term Indians to refer to them. So welcome to Confucian City, that's not going to go away anytime soon. What emerges from there are a few key systems. Europeans are able to supply financial capital for expeditions to the West, and they now have a source of labour in this process from all those West African slaves. And now Columbus has discovered this new world that will provide raw materials, especially gold, land and lumber, to fuel that trade. When these two worlds meet, there's a biological event known as the Columbian Exchange, and it's really not possible to talk too much about it. It's a trade of life in just all forms. These continents have been separated for an incredibly long period of time. We're realistically talking so long that animals, from the large herd animals all the way down to some bacteria, have developed in separation. So, coming from that new world, the Americas, to Europe, you get maize, potatoes, tobacco, beans, squash, peppers. You even get tomatoes. I mean, the Italians import tomatoes from the new world. You also get the disease syphilis, which had never been seen outside of America before. Then, going the other way, from Europe and Asia to the Americas, you get cows, pigs, horses, wheat, sugarcane, apples, cabbage, citrus fruit. Even the type of grass known as Kentucky bluegrass, that's not indigenous to Kentucky. Also, well, smallpox, yellow fever, malaria. The native peoples of the Americas had no contact with these diseases, meaning they had no immunities, which built up over generations. The people who have immunities, at least a partial immunity, survive and pass that immunity on to the next generation. For example, people in Europe had lived alongside cows for so long, they become accustomed to a disease called cowpox, which is a much milder relative of smallpox. This had helped them to build at least a partial immunity to smallpox. It was far less devastating when it hit European communities than when it hit the native peoples who had zero immunity and had never encountered anything like the disease before. There are estimates that up to 90% of all pre-Columbian native peoples died from disease within a century of European arrival. Certainly, by the time Europeans were arriving to colonize the east coast of North America, the numbers there were dramatically lower than a century before, because of the diseases that tore through those communities. When European explorers describe the American continent as being an empty land, it's that way not because there were no native peoples there to begin with, but because European diseases had emptied it. So the Spanish were very quick to capitalize on this discovery, and the groups known as conquistadors embarked on several expeditions to explore this land. The Treaty of Torre de las Salas in 1494 was a treaty between Portugal and Spain about who'd control this new land. And the Pope drew a line. He was a figure both Catholic nations respected to make this decision impartially. The Pope drew a line north to south, and Portugal got everything east of the line, and Spain got everything west of the line. As this turns out, it gave Portugal Brazil and all of Africa. Spain got everything west of the line, which is basically all of the American continent. That sounds like a bad deal in hindsight, but if you're Portugal, that looked pretty awesome at the time. They had no idea how much was west of that line. So notable conquistadors you need to know about. Vasco de Balboa was the first European to reach the Pacific Ocean going west. He got across the Isthmus of Panama. Ferdinand Magellan went down the bottom of South America around Cape Horn and back up to circumnavigate the globe. Ponce de Leon landed in and named Florida, meaning land of flowers. Hernando de Soto landed in Florida, headed north and west, and ended up being buried in the Mississippi. Francisco Pizarro is the guy who went off and conquered the Inca and began shipping huge amounts of gold and silver back to Spain. The massive influx of precious metals meant the prices for these collapsed. Even though this initially enriched Spain, what it really did was cause an economic collapse and massive inflation in most of Europe, as the value of all their gold and silver dropped suddenly. Francisco Coronado headed into the southwest North America, and he was the first European to make contact with those Pueblo tribes we talked about before. Meanwhile, on the islands initially conquered by Spain, what you watch develop is the encomienda system. This is a system where natives would be entrusted to Spanish landlords to look after and guide them, to introduce them to Christianity, and to improve, by which we make them more European. It was a lofty and noble-sounding idea, but it was really just a pretense to disguise slavery. Okay, let's talk about Mexico. Hernan de Cortes set out from Cuba to modern-day Veracruz, and he marched towards the Aztec capital. And as he went, he came into contact with various groups who had previously been conquered by the Aztecs, and he convinced them to help him overthrow the Aztec king. There are a lot of different explanations why the Aztecs reacted the way they did to Cortes. One of the more prevalent ones was the idea that Moctezuma, the Aztec emperor, thought that Cortes might be an incarnation of the god Quetzalcoatl. So, whatever the story, Moctezuma welcomed the Spanish into Tenochtitlan, and once that happened, well, the Spanish desire for gold really caused the two sides to very quickly come to blows. But honestly, smallpox is what eventually defeated the Aztecs. The Spanish had left enough germs behind when they fought their way out of Tenochtitlan that when they returned to besiege the city, the defenders were drastically reduced. The site of Tenochtitlan became the modern-day Mexico City, and it served as the new Spanish capital in the region. A new race would effectively emerge from this merging, known by the Spanish as mestizos. And this is a mix of Spanish and native peoples, and that also bears pausing to think about. In the Spanish and French colonies, the concept of intermarriage between the Europeans and the native peoples was considered at least socially acceptable, and happened quite a bit. In contrast, in the English colonies, it was completely the opposite. It was considered very unacceptable for that kind of marriage by most polite society. This led to A, very different treatment of the native peoples by the Europeans in different regions, and B, a very different legacy of that relationship to the present day. So, it's really interesting to note how different those relationships developed. It's also, of course, interesting to theorise about what would happen if the French or the Spanish would become to dominate North America. Would we have seen the genocide that emerged against those native peoples if it had not been the English who were the dominant empire? I personally find it a little unlikely. Spanish America did spread very quickly into Central and Southern America, but there were threats from their neighbours. The English, especially John Cabot, who, like Columbus, was actually Italian by birth but sailing for the English, touched on the coast of the modern United States. Italy sent Giovanni de Verrazzano, who mapped some of the North American seaboard. The French sent Jacques Cartier, who sailed up the St. Lawrence River, claiming much of Canada for the French. And to help secure their holdings, Spain set up a whole series of forts up the modern Californian coast and in Florida. St. Augustine in Florida is officially the first permanent settlement in North America, and its purpose was very clearly to defend the Spanish holdings from Europeans. In consolidating this power, you see people like Don Juan de Onate marching to modern-day New Mexico and conquer the people there, ruthlessly subduing them. Maiming was his main strategy. He was known for cutting off one foot from all those who opposed him. Despite efforts from Spanish priests, who had come with them and worked to convert the Pueblo peoples, they revolted in what was known as Pope's Rebellion. This led to increasing mistrust from the Spanish and an increase in harsh treatment in some places. Certainly, when we look back, we see kind of an inevitability to Spanish conquest in these areas. But it's worth noting Pope's Rebellion because it's the first time we can see North American tribes push back and at least temporarily drive the Spanish out of their lands. Meanwhile, in the east, Robert de La Salle sailed down the Mississippi River, and he claimed the whole region for France, naming it Louisiana after the French king. This started a trend for all the place names in that region, from La Salle in Illinois to Louisville, all the way down to New Orleans. Also worth noting in this period is we have emerging what is known as the Black Legend. The black legend is the notion that the Spanish brought only bad treatment and cruel experiences to native peoples, and more importantly, that they were somehow uniquely cruel to them. And to a degree, that's true. They certainly did bring death, mistreatment, and suffering to the people they encountered. And to a certain degree, they were far worse than that handed out by some of the other colonial powers in this period. The English, Dutch, French, Swedish, etc. So yes, it is terrible. We also have to be able to balance these things. Can we also say they brought with them some ideas of agriculture, infrastructure, technology, architecture? Perhaps even give them good points for positive intentions in spreading religion. Of course, it's more complicated. You're going to see a very different take on this if you read Howard Zinn than if you read a conventional textbook. And that's primarily a clash between different schools of thought on history. Most people will see the truth of the black legend as the most important thing. You can bring all the architecture you want, but if you engage in torture and genocide, then it's probably not going to be considered an equal exchange in anybody's book. Next episode, we will discuss the first English people reaching the Americas. And it's going to focus primarily on the southern colonies, because chronologically they're going to emerge first. We'll take a bit of a deep dive into Virginia and Jamestown, and a little nod to other places and the way they've developed.